Hello. Here at Fusion Patrol, we are constantly striving to make the audio quality of our podcasts as high as possible. And every once in a while, that doesn't really go to plan. And I do apologize in advance for what you're about to hear. Not because of what we're talking about, although if you ever watched the episode that we're discussing, I apologize to you for that. But because, for some reason, the audio was overdriven, and it didn't appear that way when we were recording it, but it's led to some dropouts in the audio and some distortion. But I have listened to the entire podcast and believe that you can understand what we're trying to say, and hopefully it won't be too terribly distracting. I apologize, and we will try to do better in the future. And now, on with the show. I've always wanted to say that. Listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
My name's Hyde.
And Hyde and I are going to be looking at another exciting episode of Man from Atlantis. This time, the called C.W. Hyde. I think this is about the 13th episode, but I...
It is.
I didn't pay attention to this. Lucky 13.
Yeah. And no. It aired on December 13th.
Probably back in the 70s or something.
1977.
Yeah. 1977. Okay, so before I get into the review of this, I want to say in advance that I had my reasons for picking this episode out.
That was to torture me.
And it wasn't actually to torture Ben.
I don't believe that. I don't believe that.
It wasn't actually to torture Ben, but it was... there was
what, to torture David?
Anyone who'll watch, it is a bit torturous, but we'll get to it. I just want to say, as we go, because I know that the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to say, so, Ben, what did you think of this episode?
Oh, God.
That bad, huh?
I found, okay, not as bad as The Naked Montague.
Which, as I recall, you had, you went into
I went into pure frenzy. I was just so angry at watching that. However, this one did thoroughly piss me off in bad ways, and I'm sorry. Pardon me for using any hyperbole, but I honestly thought this episode was just one big pile of shit.
Is that technically hyperbole, or is that more of a metaphor?
Yes.
Yes. Now, I did observe some of your reaction while you were watching it yesterday. As it happens, David and I were watching it. David is not here, by the way. He's just... being mentioned incidentally because he got subjected to this too. And he had a couple points which I wrote down. But, and you know, we were worried about you, Ben. We thought you were having a heart attack. Literally. You were describing symptoms or like, you know, Ben, maybe you should go to the ER if it's
doing this. I was not. I was just, the episode was emotionally stressing me out in the worst imaginable way.
Why? Or should we describe what the episode's about first, if you can't figure it out from the name, C.W. Hyde?
It's just stupid, insulting. And to watch a television show, I mean, one, the series has just gotten from bad to worse. And it has degenerated something that I find to be so utterly distasteful and so completely unpleasant that just the mere thought of having to watch anything from this show fills me with such resentment that I just become this incredibly stressed out maniac at having to watch what I think has got to be television at one of its darkest and saddest times.
I'm going to say margaritas may be the answer. But
well, any kind of alcohol, well, I don't know. I mean, no, alcohol generally kind of makes me a happy person, but I'm afraid what it might do under those circumstances, it might have the adverse effect and end up putting my foot through the television screen, and I don't think I'd want to do that.
Oh, fair enough. All right, well, let's briefly describe the episode before I give my... You may have guessed from the episode title, C-W-H-Y-D-E, as in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, or Dr. Jekyll, if you prefer that variation of it. And like The Naked Montague, which was a time-honored tradition on American television of ripping off Romeo and Juliet, this was a time-honored American television tradition of ripping off Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. In it, C.W. Crawford, the head of the foundation, is accidentally exposed to this substance, and he becomes a somewhat hairy version of himself. He was on the prowl for his pleasures, and is not at all a nice guy. Gets involved with some mobsters, endangers incredible American secret surveillance equipment, and teaches us a valuable lesson about addiction and drug problems. All in one tidy half hour. 47 minute little gem of a television show. I'm don't get me wrong. I think this episode is bad. It has some of the worst things that I dislike about television from that era. Gross, stereotypical characters. Rampant use of, well, gross stereotypical situations and characters. It's really bad. And it is really bad. It's not by far so bad that you have a foot kicked through the television. But
well, not on a sober day, but if I were completely blitzed on alcohol, God knows what I might do watching it.
There's a lot insulting about this, and or just incredibly slipshod. I mean, for example, if you were to compare it to the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you would know that Dr. Jekyll invented a serum that transformed him into Mr. Hyde as a result of an experiment kind of along those lines. Not quite what he was after, but, you know, kind of along those lines. In this, we are introduced to some incredible plot contrivance of Mark and Elizabeth standing around a Erlenmeyer flask, or some other form of glassware. Actually, it's a more complicated piece of glassware with a convenient spigot at the bottom of it.
Yeah, wasn't that nice
for easy dispensing? And it is in less than two sentences, or perhaps three sentences, explained that Mark found this substance at the bottom of the ocean and thought it was interesting. That's why he brought it back. And it's the scrapings of enzymes off some fossilized rock. Which, of course, you don't fossilize rock. You have bones that become fossils. So rock, fossils, bone turns to rock is fine. But nonetheless, it's got this enzyme. And just a quick brief analysis by the people by putting it in a thing and heating it over a Bunsen burner tells us that it could have dramatic effects on the human personality. Now, that is just like completely and utterly the lamest, worst explanation of any MacGuffin I think I've ever heard in an episode of a TV show. I mean, that was just really like...
It's right up there with many other MacGuffins that they've had with this TV series. Just come up with the lamest explanation and pray to God that it'll stick.
That it sticks. And it is just as bad as swimming and ending up in Italy.
Yeah. Or having a computer that analyzes Mark and can't come up with any other explanation except to say, last man from Atlantis. It's right up there with that.
It is. It is.
nonsense.
Appallingly bad stuff. Well, meanwhile, there's been this U.S. Navy deep water submersible that has gotten stuck in very deep water. And it's got this important thing on it. And a recorder, data recorder, is what they need out of it. And it's up to Mark and Elizabeth to go get it. So as CW comes in to talk to him about it, he happens to conveniently set his coffee underneath the spigot that was on the previously mentioned bit of glassware in the lab. And about that time, for no apparent reason, it starts dripping the enzyme stuff into his...
But only then.
But only then, that's right. There's no stain on the desk or anything like it had been
not
dripping
before
all along,
or after.
Or after. He picks it up and then it stops. So apparently it's got some sort of proximity sensor. You put a coffee cup under it, it dispenses. Mark and Elizabeth go off. Now they gave the coordinates of this sunk submersible, which is 136 west, 27.5. Now, I checked that out because... if I can't be pedantic about this show, then there's no point in watching it. Now, we never did figure out where the Foundation for Oceanic Research is. Is it in San Diego? Is it in Los Angeles?
It's somewhere near Southern California.
Southern California.
I kind of got the feeling. I don't know.
Well,
it depends on the episode. Sometimes it feels like San Diego. Sometimes it.
Well, right off the bat, I mean, just looking at those coordinates, 136 west, 27.3. south means you're on the other side of the equator.
Well, that'll put it closer to San Diego then.
No, I mean where the submersible got sunk.
Well, I mean
yeah.
I was referring to the oceanic.
Yeah.
It'll make sense for their...
They're definitely in California. But yeah, the this thing, I mean, when he said that and he said this is in the south, I was like, that's going to be weeks away by submarine.
Oh, but Mark can be there in mere minutes. Well, true.
Anyway, if you started at New Zealand and you headed straight across for South America and you got halfway there, stopped. That's about where this is.
So it's
4,400 miles from the rough area of Southern California in a straight line.
So just like with in this show, how they just say something and hope that it sticks. Let's just make up some coordinates that, you know, luckily they found something that was actually in water. It would have been great if they had actually given us land coordinates.
They got there and back. And as best I can tell from the nature of the story, they got there and back in less than
a day.
Let's say maybe 36 hours. Maybe 36 hours. Because it could have left early in the day, and then it could have been late in the next day when they arrived, got back. But it's clearly the very next day. So, and in fact, they don't arrive there. Arrive at the location the next day, because right after they leave, CW drinks the coffee and transforms into his alter ego, and he leaves. When they arrive at the place... The secretary, who is Herb Solo's daughter, by the way.
Oh, I didn't know that.
The producer, or executive producer of the show, tells them that CW's been missing...
All day.
Right, actually, since yesterday.
Yeah.
He's been missing since yesterday. So that means they got 4,400 miles within 24 hours. If it were 12 hours, they would have to be traveling at about 300 miles an hour, which we already worked out on the submarines, and even Mark Harris is utterly impossible. So they must have gone through one of the various wormholes that he's found and then popped out on the other thing. But it's complete idiocy on the part of the writer to just plunk down coordinates somewhere
without even bothering to check them.
You know, even think about it for a little
bit. But why should if they can just come up with the most lame of scientific plot devices without even the slightest bit of thought, then just inventing numbers and just writing them down like that.
Yeah, why not?
That's nothing. Why
the audience
not?
Is idiots, so we don't care. And there's also a little bit of added that there's an explosive device on the deep sea probe, and CW, because of the transformation, doesn't bother to tell them. And so they're out there, and you know, they've got their 30 meters deep, I believe is what they said, and this explosion's going to go off, and it's going to be so big, it's going to cause a tsunami. So Mark using his fish powers. So that was really
added
nothing.
Fish power.
That was just to kill some time. I mean, this basically
just kills. Yeah, that entire bit was padding.
Yeah, this story is not about Mark or Elizabeth at all, really.
No.
I did say there's one thing that just on the retrieval of the thing, after they got the bomb out, defused the bomb, Elizabeth says, you know, look at the order. It's a box that's 8 by 6 by 4 centimeters.
No, it wasn't.
No, it wasn't. It's a box about the size of an old-style tape recorder.
Yes.
It's about 8 inches by...
I'm thinking inches by centimeters.
She said centimeters on the thing.
Her exact quote was 8 centimeters by 6 by 4.
Yeah.
Now, when you preface it by saying 8 centimeters, you kind of assume that the 6 and the 4 are also centimeters.
It has to be.
8 centimeters by 6 inches by 4 inches. I mean, that's just nonsense. So yeah, when he pulled that out, I thought, oh, that's wow, that was new math.
That was, yeah, back in the days when they were trying to get people interested in the metric system in the United States in 77. So that could be what it was. It's just, see, it's very familiar measurements. We say it's 8 by 6 by 4 centimeters. It's the same as inches.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about C.W. Crawford. People who've watched the show will know that Alan Fudge, or whatever the actor's
name
is, Fudge, who plays the character, is a bit bald. Balding, anyway. And he takes this, and he grows hair on the back of his palms, or his hands, quite bushy. He gets a monobrow, a bushy and a lovely full head of hair. I mean, not wild or anything. It's just, it's like he actually has hair.
And it was fast. I mean, Grecian formulas got nothing.
Yeah, it happened, you know, it was the typical fade transformation, and then, shoo, there you go.
Right, and just seconds after he drank the coffee.
Yeah, he started to feel funny after the first sip. Yeah.
That's some fast-working enzyme.
Those enzymes from the bottom of the sea are
quite
aggressive. Yeah. So he gets up, hides from his secretary until she's out of the way, the door, steals $150 that's been raised to contribute to a member of the institute who's just had a baby, and he walks out with the cash. You know, and so just to prove, is he evil? He'd take from a poor woman who's just about to have a baby.
Well, as he later states, he's basically a moral leper.
Which is
a very strange term. He's like, what is that supposed to mean?
Yeah.
What kind of a, he calls himself a moral leper at one point. I thought, okay, I become a moral leper. That's interesting.
So he goes out, commandeers a taxi, playing the tough guy kind of thing.
Oh, we must point out the scenery. The scene.
Yeah, what is he? Yeah, he's down like at the docks or something.
Well, it's like, what? Is this supposed to be London? Are they trying to, you know, are they really trying to cheat on or cheap copying idea of the whole Jekyll and Hyde story? And now he's in some back alley and there's a fog going on?
And why was he hiding from headlights? Did you notice that? He was like ducking and stuff. It's like, you haven't done anything, dude. What are you hiding for? It's just like he was skulking around, and then he sees a guy getting a taxi, so he has to throw his weight around. And everybody who looks at him, they just get for some reason. You know, I mean, yeah, the monobrow is a little bit much, but
he reaches over, he touches them. For a second, I'm thinking, oh, is this another one of these contagious things where he touches somebody and all of a sudden they're affected? I mean,
that was originality in this story.
Yeah. But
so
no, they just all kind of flipped out by looking at him and did whatever he wanted.
Yeah, and they were like, yeah, okay, bud, I'll do. So he takes a taxi and he tells the guy he wants to go someplace where there's some action.
Someplace hot.
Someplace hot. And then he says, that's with class, infested, if you know what I mean. Now, what does he mean?
I'm not sure.
Does he mean a place where the women don't have lice? I mean, are we talking literally talking about infested?
Because he's talking in metaphors all over the place. So I had no idea what the heck he really meant. You know, it was
so. Taxi cab driver took him someplace that he ended up liking.
So what about this place? I mean, he goes into this place. It's got can't think of the word now. French word guy.
It's an obnoxious, maitre d'.
Maitre d'. There we go. And it's playing like piano.
It had this, it was a ragtime feel, and I thought, oh, it was a ragtime speakeasy.
It was like a speakeasy, except also had the feel of an old West saloon to me. Yeah, it wasn't a saloon, obviously, because they weren't cowboys and stuff.
There's an actual bar there, but it had sort of that roughness to it, yet it was classy.
Let's face it, a whorehouse.
Yeah. In fact, actually, that's what I first thought it was, because you don't see the maitre d'. You're seeing who we find out later is actually some sort of a hostess, but I thought she was the madame.
Yeah.
Walks in.
It is a old West style, you know, I mean, they don't talk about it on Gunsmoke, but, you know, the saloon down there and Miss Kitty and all, they were whores. They were prostitutes. That was a house of prostitution. Did. Bar downstairs, rooms upstairs. And that's what this place obviously is meant to be. It's a whorehouse.
It's a whorehouse.
And it's playing that silly music as if they had
a piano player
there. It's all donkey. And, of course, he's not interested in just any woman. He wants the one who is, frankly, not the best looking of the bunch.
And not the brightest bulb in the package, either.
Oh, my. One of the stereotypes, hugely stupid.
Here
woman.
Is where the stereotypes really turn sour.
Yeah, the of course, up to this point, we haven't seen any outside characters. But once we're meeting these people, then they absolutely. And of course, everybody's like, you know, he's mean to the bartender. He asks for champagne. He gives him champagne. He doesn't like it. He pours it all over the counter because it's no good. Give me the good stuff.
It's house champagne. Well, let's see how the house likes it.
Kind of, then he demands the expensive bottle of champagne, and you know the guy doesn't want to give it to him, but the maitre d' kind of gives him the nod. So, all right, go ahead and give it to him. It's like, if he's willing to pay for it, why would you?
Why refuse?
That didn't make any sense either. Then he takes it over to the woman at the table, and they're all like, "Oh, that's Mr. Cavendish. Is it Cavendish?
Calendar.
Calendar. Mr. Calendar's.
Lou Calendar's girl.
Lou Calendar's girl." And he goes over and he sits down and he tries to put the moves on her, and she is not interested, seemingly. And then Mr. Calendar comes in, and he is stereotype number two. He's a gangster. You know, he's in a pinstripe suit. If he had been wearing a hat, he would have been right out of a 1930s gangster film.
This is where the whole thing turned into a mob episode.
Yes, now it's suddenly mob, and he's got, you know, three or four guys that are all stupid. He's got the driver who's actually wearing a chauffeur's outfit, and he's got two thugs and
sporting sunglasses.
Nice. And
it's such a
they have a little bit of dialogue, and CW, who is going by the name of CW Cash, is a made up name, is talks him down, convinces him that he's a player. And you know, he's just a way of getting introduced and stuff. And in the meantime, the girl has decided, ooh, and slips him her room key. Grossly obviously.
It's a huge honking key. It's not something you can easily slip.
No. And she, like, puts her hand on his hand with a key in it, like, between his fingers. The five guys there are not noticing that at all, and so he leaves. And then the next time we see him, he's in bed in a bubble bath in the room. It's the next day, and he has transformed back.
He's reverted,
and he wakes up and realizes what he's been doing, and he has obviously been doing, and I hate the fact she comes she comes sauntering out of the bubble bath, which do people really get? I don't know. I don't take bubble baths, but do people actually get out of bubble baths and just towel off? With still all over their bodies?
I don't know.
I assumed you had to drain the tub and then rinse yourself off. Otherwise, you're going to have bubble bath all over, soap all over you, basically.
It did look a little weird as she came out, but then it was to please the censors.
That may have been to please the censors there, or, you know, to get the feel. But she comes out, and she's crawling all over him, and she said, "Hey, Tiger, I'm feeling lonely again." It's like,
say no more.
Lonely? Is this the euphemism for horny?
Horny.
And then,
this is 1977.
It is 1977, but seriously, I'm feeling lonely. You're with the guy. You're not lonely. Lonely's a poor euphemism in that situation.
Again, I mean, I agree. It's a stupid line.
So who is this episode for? Now, this is the part that gets me. This episode is dumb that you would be easily forgiven. With this and several of the other episodes we've watched, the Naked Montague and all those episodes, you could be easily forgiven if you said, you know something, the in this show, we're aiming it at 10, 12-year-old kids. And I'm fine with that. But this episode, I mean, really? This is pretty... Yeah, okay, when I was 10, 12, I might not have... At 10, 12, I would have figured out what was going on there, but... Sort of.
Well, I would have pretty much figured it out just from the scenery, but from the dialogue?
Yeah, it's
What are you trying to do?
What are you fooling?
This is like, are we trying to have an adult tale here? I mean, adult in the stupid adult way, but I mean...
Or are they simply trying to reemphasize the fact that this woman is a complete harebrain?
In any case, it's a stupid line.
That's really...
I mean, it's just completely unbelievable. Bad characterization. It just... It's totally unbelievable.
And so CW squeaks his way out, but not before dropping money that he stole and a piece of paper that has his name and his address at work on it.
Oh, how convenient.
Which is apparently just bundled up in his pants pocket. And he rushes back to the Institute, and this is about the time that Mark and Elizabeth were on their way back. Matter of fact, I think maybe they did arrive back at that point. Yeah, they had arrived back, and they were.
They got back before CW did.
They chastised him a little bit about.
Well, no, CW gets back.
Not telling him about the bomb.
No, not yet. CW first, and then is ditching Sarah, the receptionist.
Well, he did that so that he could put the money back because he found out about the robbery.
True.
And he ditched her. He sent her out to get a sandwich so that he could get back in. And that's about when...
And then I think Sarah... And I think it's at that point that Mark and Elizabeth come in.
They come in and they kind of, you know, dress him down a little bit. It's like, you know, CW, how could you not tell us about the bomb? It's like, I mean, you're Mr. Why weren't you here? You're, you know, all this stuff. I'm sorry, I had problems, okay? And then they're like, okay, we're just, you know, we just care about you.
We just care.
And but their tone was really odd. I mean, all right, you know, the talking about the fact that he had been missing overnight and that the money had been stolen. Like, if this is so out of character for him, wouldn't you have been thinking, I hope something didn't happen to him, that somebody came and stole the money and hurt him? You know, I would have equated the two odd events with one another. I wouldn't have thought he stole the money. But I would have thought, you know, whoever stole
I would have made some
money.
Kind of a connection.
Yeah, I would have been a lot more...
I would not have viewed them as two separate incidents.
And the cavalier attitude that they treated him being missing. I mean, I don't know where he is. It's like, I would be worried if he was missing during a major...
Well, as Elizabeth points out, I mean, he's... Without saying it, I mean, she pretty much makes the case that he's very anal retentive. He is Mr. Punctuality. So for him to be missing like that would clearly imply that something may have happened. And I would have put out, you know, like an all-points bulletin, contacted the authorities, especially someone of his position.
Yeah.
You would easily contact someone in authority and say, okay, you know, it's very
realistic of him to be gone
Instead, they are very cavalier about his absence. And all they do is just kind of like, oh, that's just not like him. How could he be doing that? And then they brush it off.
Do the thing, yeah. So once Elizabeth and Mark are gone, he had previously taken his cup of coffee and dumped out his bottle of mouthwash and filled up the bottle as Mr. Ash. And now he's back in his office and he's thinking about the woman. He's thinking about, you know, hey, Tiger, I'm feeling lonely.
And he already knows at this point, and he knows that it's been terrible. He's already made the claim, what kind of a moral leper have I become?
Did he say that to himself?
Yes, he did.
Okay.
He said that to himself in his office. He was peering through the blinds, and he was just after he'd already kind of dressed down Sarah for asking him where he had been.
Mm-hmm.
And that, so he already had a sense.
He knew he was doing something wrong, but he obviously liked it.
He knew.
So he pulls out the bottle and he's looking at the bottle and, you know, it's like.
Well, here's where we get into the whole case of addiction.
Yeah.
And again, this was insulting. The way they handle the whole addiction right here, because he knows that he's done this terrible thing, and yet he looks at himself in the mirror as he's about to take a sip, and he gets this wily grin on his face.
And then drinks it.
I thought. Well,
which, you know, is kind of the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde thing. I mean, that was the thing Jekyll was doing. He would knowingly take it again, even though he knew he was doing terrible and abhorrent things. I think it, if I recall the book correctly, it wasn't until he murdered someone that he decided he needed to stop. And that's when
that
he found out.
That was his rock bottom.
And then he found out he couldn't, that it was happening anyway, as I. So, you know, this is, so CW is straight back to the girl who has found the piece of paper, turned the piece of paper over to Mr. Colander, and they're all waiting for him when he shows up because they think he's like a Fed or working for some secret military organization. And so he explains to them how, yeah, I get lots of secret stuff and I, you know, bring you this top secret item, we can sell it, make a lot of money. And then he notices he's changing back. He didn't drink as much. There's an interesting thing about the whole much too. So he's getting that whole thing and he's like, I'm gonna go out and see the girl. So he drinks the stuff in his office and then has to sneak out again. Like, he was clearly in possession of his own faculties, so why didn't he just leave the foundation first and then drink it when no one's looking? But then they would have had to have another set. They'd have had to take him down to the waterfront again or something. So he leaves. He scarpers off in a real hurry because he knows he's transforming back. And this time he comes back and he tells Mark. He says, Mark, I've done a terrible thing. And, you know, me, and they talk about the stuff and... You know, it's like, well, you got to give this stuff up, and CW won't hand over the bottle.
He says, you'll have to take it from me.
Yeah, holding it out in front of him, Mark, clasping his hand, he says, you're going to take that from me. So Mark takes it out of his hand.
It's not just, like just takes it out of his hand, and CW says, thank you.
Thank you.
And, no.
But nobody pours it out.
No, apparently, CW has specifically asked Mark not to do this. I kind of get the sense that Mark is going to take it to Elizabeth anyway, and they're going to analyze what this is, because Mark, I don't think Mark has figured it out at this point. This was some of the liquid that he and Elizabeth had been analyzing earlier. I mean, he hasn't made that connection yet.
Maybe not. You know, who knows who's made what connection in this story, but...
But boy, wasn't it convenient that Mark...
Wasn't it just convenient that Mark kept it? And then the crooks decide, rather than waiting, they're going to show up. The mob. They're going to show up and they're gonna bust some fingers. Secretary, or so she can't type if we bust all her fingers. And they want the thing turned over, which Mark happens to have. And as we said, it's a, you know, it's just sort of. And at first they think it's the bus.
It's 8 centimeters by 6 by 4.
At first they think the thing he's got might be the thing, but, you know, because it's a recorder, but it's just a black box, right? And CW very cleverly says to him, well, does that look like a recorder to you? I mean, there's no tapes, there's no
actually,
slot.
Actually, it wasn't CW that said – well, yeah, the CW does say that, but then it's also Lou's girl who says –
Top secret stickers on it, or emblems, government emblems, stuff like that. That was, yeah. But I thought it's no slot.
You're right. CW does make the comment that it would have slots. You know,
put a cassette slot and stuff. It doesn't have that.
You're right.
That's not the thing. And so they're threatening the receptionist with broken fingers if CW doesn't turn over the device, and then Mark makes a gambit play and says, well, he cannot tell you, for he does not know where I hid it. And so they...
This was the slimmest idea.
This was the slimmest.
This
about this
so
time...
slim.
This time, the mobster, one of the chauffeur, I think it was, comes out of the back. And he's like, hey, boss, you gotta see this back here.
There's a big tank of water back there, boss.
There's a big tank of water back there. Really? Well, let's take our boy in there. And so they take Mark in there and says to him, how long can you hold your breath? How long can you breathe underwater? He says, as long as I need to.
We should point out that when CW talking to Mark,
yes,
CW was already afraid that Lou and his thugs were going to show up. And he asks Mark, how long have you been dry? And I forgot how many hours.
6 hours and says, well, you need to get yourself wet. That way you can have your super strength
back.
You'll
have your strength back, yeah. He did say that. So they take Mark in the back, and the two guys hold his head down under the water.
A bet.
Oh, yeah. They're timing.
They make a bet that he could, because I think Lou says something about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And then CW kind of says to the gal, take the bet.
Yeah. And so they put Mark under there, and one guy's standing there. The other two guys are holding him in, and then Mark's just down there, and they're 55 seconds, a minute, and then suddenly Mark starts thrashing a little bit, and the guy says, what, can't you hold him down? And he just lifts up
in full $6 million slow-mo fashion.
Yeah, or Incredible Hulk, and dives into his water tank, and I think picks the other guy up and throws him into the water tank, and then he comes out and goes to the phone, and I'm going to call the police now, Mr. Colander, and tell them what you stay. And Colander pulls a gun on him, and then, or actually more specifically, pulls a gun on the receptionist, and so Mark has to put the gun down, or has to put the phone down, and then I'll let you tell it. I can't.
Well, he gives Lou this big speech about how taking this is black box
is such a bad thing, and the cost of millions of dollars of taxpayer money.
It's wrong.
And it's wrong to do that, and then splashes Lou over the head with bits of the liquid that he got from CW. At which point, Lou becomes Mother Teresa.
Or actually a nice person.
he becomes a person with sense of morals and complete decency.
You're right. I, and he doesn't grow hair, he doesn't lose hair.
Doesn't change,
like, doesn't
does not change appearance.
No, he just instantly...
And I figure the whole nature of the transformation
was just completely nonsensical. But if that were the case... If CW is going to turn into this hairy beast and become this man who is completely amoral,
then some kind of transformation should have happened, and Lou should have come out looking like the Greek god Apollo, I would imagine.
Of course, now he got it poured over his head as opposed to drinking it. Maybe only when you drink it do you grow hair.
Mm.
Could be, you know, the enzymes.
It's possible. It's possible, but
yes, he immediately becomes a nice guy. Says, "You're right. I shouldn't be stealing it. And, you know, maybe I into the seminary," and he takes his mobster guys, and they leave peaceably. And that's the end, basically. I mean...
Yeah. More or less.
More or less, yeah. There's a little bit of, you know, CW and Elizabeth now know what's... Or Elizabeth now knows what's going on, because she wasn't really involved in this episode.
Except for her... Mark on the sub.
Yeah, and the one bit where she came into CW's office earlier, but she wasn't there for any of the showdown at the end.
No, this was
like
this was really... She had, like, very little role...
More Elizabeth Light.
Very episode. Elizabeth Light.
And yeah, I mean, that's... Then the episode ends. They don't send the cops after them. They don't have a running gun battle. They don't kill anybody.
Well,
it's really...
And, well, even Sarah makes the point. Aren't you going to do something? I mean, he terrified us. He threatened us. And Mark said, and they left. And no one was hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, that was stupid. So, like, you know, that's he's not going to stay that way, right? Nasty in a little bit, and then he'll be back.
Now, there was a little tiny bit of payoff about the box, because apparently there was some kind of dispute about the nature of the submersible between different government agencies. And that's why the box was such a big deal. And so, yeah, there was a little bit of payoff on that, and how, because of the recovery, the foundation is now going to be receiving lots and lots of funds from the government. A little bit about that, but again, that was just more needless padding.
It was needless padding. Well, I did forget there was one thing that happened at the end that we should mention. So Elizabeth is there with Mark, and talking about, you know, it's okay, your checkout physical says you're fine. We did some analysis. There's some interesting properties to that stuff. And then C says he needs a break or a rest, or he's going on taking the weekend off or something like that. And he starts to head, and he won't say what he's doing. And he starts to head out. And as he starts, Mark reaches over and takes the room key of the whore.
Well, CW kind of flips the keys in the air, like, yeah. You know, and then Mark just grabs
takes
the key and holds it, and then gives him a smile. And I thought, oh my God, Mentos commercial. Because that's how they end, always.
With a smile? Or with somebody
taking
their room
key? They're holding in the Mentos commercial, they're holding the candy, and they give this stupid little smile, and. Just replace the candy with a key, and that's what Mark gave. He gave CW a stupid smile as he was holding it.
So apparently, are we to take from this that CW in his ordinary form was going to go back and give it another with the
apparently.
Hooker? Yeah.
That's certainly how it appeared.
Because she was such a winner. I mean,
oh, yeah.
She was... unattractive. Don't get me wrong. She's
no,
an actress.
She wasn't
I've seen
unattractive.
Lots of things, but
I mean
she was stupid as a brick.
She was thick as a brick,
and
just dumb.
Yeah, too dumb to.
And
in her voice,
even had that stereotypical speech pattern. That, well, Lou, I found this, and oh please, the stereotypes here are insulting.
Yeah, I think at one point, the type of person, like I say, they can't stop their own inner voice. At one point, Colander's talking to her, and he says, "That guy is a tiger."
That's
and,
what I said.
He says, yeah, that's what I said. What do you mean by
what?
That? Oh,
nothing.
It's like, okay, just rub it in the guy's face. It was really bad. It truly was bad. It's a bad episode, and I make no excuses for it. I just don't find it a bad episode that's like frustratingly, agonizingly mad, bad kind of. You know, some things will get me mad, and I can understand your frustration.
Episode actually made me mad.
With Naked Montague, I could see that because
Naked pissed me off.
Naked
Montague
is an. I don't mean to put one above the other, but I mean, we are talking about, bending over a bar stool and raping, one of the greatest playwrights language and one of his probably better known masterpieces of playwright literature in the world. And I love Stevenson and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is a timeless
it's a classic.
Classic story, but it's not in the same league. And so you are not quite debasing something level.
No. And that's true.
You know, I could see the frustration. It was like, I can't believe you're doing this to Shakespeare. But this one was kind of, you know, it is a science fiction-y story. It's a sort of science fiction-y TV series. Whereas, you know, Romeo and Juliet isn't. So it's, to me, it's just a serious miss. It's a miscalculated episode. They miscalculated what they should do with the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde story. They miscalculated who their audience was. They miscalculated what they should do with the characters because, you know, there's no evidence that anyone has sex anywhere else ever in the entire series of Man from Atlantis, except in this episode. They miscalculated the stereotypes of the characters. I mean, it's just a miss.
It was a miss all over the place. Fail.
Big fail!
Yeah. Now, I've gone on to say that, yes, this episode, not as bad as Naked Montague, but even with that, it, in my opinion, it rates as one of the worst stories I've ever watched. Any plausibility that they may have been trying to achieve was stretched portion by totally and completely absurd acting and character portrayals of the characters that were present, especially by Alan Fudge as CW. And the idea I found the idea of the liquid causing alterations in character in that particular way completely ridiculous. And the way that it was carried and the actions by both CW and Lou Callender are completely and totally absurd, which, as far as I could see, ruined further any that this series may have been attempting to achieve.
I was
when
wondering
it premiered
if you were going to use the word credibility, because I felt like I was building up to a failure in credibility statement there, and I completely agree with you. This story has
no credibility, and now it is reduced to being nothing more than just a farce. And a bad one at that.
And a bad one at that. I think if I'm not overstepping my bounds here, I think I'm going to say that we are in agreement that this episode is one that you shouldn't bother watching.
Ever.
But of course, we know that by talking about it,
you're going to want to.
Because you don't think it's as bad. You're thinking. You're
it
over
can't
there
be that all bad.
I know what you're thinking. You people are thinking, I like Let's Kill Hitler. I don't think it was nearly so bad as that. That's the most amazing television everywhere, and you guys thought it was bad. All right. If you like Let's Kill Hitler, I want you to watch this episode of Man from Atlantis.
By all means.
Please do. Please do. So, I guess I hope you'll join us again next time on Fusion Patrol.
End of line.
You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol podcast, a production of Lone Locust Productions. Join us on our new discussion forums at fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Username Fusion Patrol. You can also send us feedback by email at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. If you'd like to support Fusion Patrol, please leave us a review on iTunes. Fusion Patrol's theme music is Fight the Future by Amberwolf.